I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. That area from the top of Vancouver Island to southern Alaska along the Pacific coast is called the Great Bear Rainforest. It's a unique part of the world inhabited by the famed pure white black bear with the various animals and lush bucolic vegetation. It's its own ecosystem, and it's all lovingly rendered in a new book, Great Bear Wild, Dispatches from a Northern Rainforest. Its author and photographer Ian McAllister joins me now to talk about the gorgeous photographs he's taken, the sort of people and creatures that find themselves there. It's a part of the world that's under threat as well. I'll get Mr. McAllister to tell us about what he sees that could be in danger if pipelines are built and if tanker traffic is allowed to marine through. Ian McAllister is the co-founder of the wildlife conservation organization Pacific Wild. He's won numerous awards for his work as a photographer. His previous books include The Great Bear Rainforest and The Last Wild Wolves. Time magazine named him one of the leaders of the 21st century. The foreword to this book is written by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The book is published by Greystone. The website for more is at pacificwild.org. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from Denny Island, British Columbia, Ian McAllister. Mr. McAllister, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So for people listening to us that might not know, I mean, I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. I had to look up where Denny Island is. Roughly, would you place that on a map for us?
Yeah. Most of our mail goes to Denman Island. But it's a small island across from Bella Bella, the Heiltsik First Nation community, up on the central coast of BC. So, yeah, not to be confused with Bella Coola. We're more on the outside, on the outer coast.
And how many people inhabit that island that you're on?
Sort of depends, but around 70.
I see. Yeah, and so what? If one wanted to come from Vancouver, say, to go there, I mean, how long a trek is that?
Well, everything's pretty well boat based up here. There are flights into Bella Bella daily, and there's a ferry that leaves from Port Hardy, stops off here on the way up to Prince Rupert and Haida Gwaii. There's no roads to our house, so everything. Once you get here, everything is pretty much boat based.
And how long have you lived there?
We've been working on conservation projects up here for over 20 years, and I guess that's how long we've been living here as well.
And you've been, where were you born?
I grew up in Victoria.
So I see.
Kind of moved north over the years and ended up here.
So you've been on the coast for a while.
Yeah.
When you talk about where you live and where you work, as you have, I'm sure, on the course of promoting this book, do you think people down south, say, like where I am, we don't understand just how vast and varied our province is?
I think that's true. I mean, British Columbia is a remarkable province in terms of cultural and ecosystem diversity, and I don't think there's very many British Columbians that really understand the full scope of it. I certainly, don't have a good understanding of the interior. I've sort of immersed myself in this one coastal rainforest coastline, and getting more and more familiar with it. But I think that certainly when people from outside of Canada come here, they're really shocked by the beauty and the diversity and the amount of life and richness and how intact it is, and I think that goes the same for people within our own borders. It's a remote place. It's not often that people have an opportunity to get off a BC ferry and explore some of these islands and fjords, but the few that do return each year because it really captivates people, and it's hard not to return once you've experienced a bit of it, and that's certainly what happened to us 20-odd years ago.
Did you get a lot of ecotourism up where you are?
Yeah, there's certainly increasing, especially wildlife-based wilderness tourism operations, community based ones out of places like Hartley Bay and Klemtu, and then there's some boat-based charter outfits that are taking people around to see bears and wolves and wildlife, and it's certainly increasing all the time. It's growing really in leaps and bounds as people from around the world begin to recognize this as a truly a globally renowned wilderness area.
And in terms of the climate and how cold it is or how warm it is in the summer, is it different than, say, here in Vancouver or in Victoria, perhaps?
Yeah, it's considerably cooler and wetter, and this place is really dominated by weather. And while it sounds like a cliche that Canadians talk about the weather a lot, there's kind of a good reason for it up here because it changes by the minute, and it can be tranquil and spectacularly warm and beautiful, and it can skip to hurricane force storm conditions in short order. So the weather really defines a lot of what this coast is about, and I think also defines the people that live here.
I guess what you do in a day is set by the weather, right?
Yeah, very much so, especially because, you know, all of our conservation work and travel and whatnot is by boat, so you know, always keeping an eye out for changing weather is definitely part of life up here.
So the photos in this book, as I said in the introduction, are just wonderful. I didn't even realize that it's British Columbia in a way, and it made me realize, I guess, that BC is more than, say, what I see in Vancouver or on the island, or in the interior, if one gets a sense of that on television or the sort. I'm interested in how you work as a photographer. So, for example, on the cover of the book is a bear. How close are you when you're shooting something like that?
Well, a lot of this book is really with wide angle, and part of the idea with that, and perhaps it's kind of the style of photography that I do, is trying to place animals in a landscape and not always, trying to just capture portraits of wildlife, but trying to fit them into, the spectacular rainforest or if it's underwater in a larger reef ecosystem. So by nature of that, you tend to have to be quite close to your subjects. So often pretty close, but it's, I think a product of this coastline that allows for so much food and for species like grizzly bears, which by nature of having a predictable food supply, they tend to be more tolerant and accommodating of people in their environment. So it does allow you to get relatively close to your subjects, yeah.
Did you touch them at all, the bears?
No, I try not to touch them.
Yeah. But if you're taking the shot as you did for the cover of the book, the bear knows you're there.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. There's probably very few images, if any, in the book that, has a situation where wildlife doesn't know them in the area. It's, there are so many of these species, especially like wolves and bears and others are quite elusive by nature and also largely nocturnal. So there's a lot of challenges in photographing wildlife on this coast, but rarely do you have an opportunity to surprise or remain hidden without being detected. So, building up trust and relationships over time with individual animals or packs of animals is pretty essential to do this type of photography.
You have a number of photographs of wolves in the book, and just looking at their eyes, they don't seem very friendly. What's your experience with wolves?
Well, I don't know about friendly, but certainly curious. And certain packs that are featured in the book are packs or extended families that I've gotten to know very well over a relatively long period of time. And a lot of those individuals I saw born as pups and have grown up over the years to become, the alpha leaders in a pack, and so they're very familiar with me and my scent and whatnot. But otherwise it would just be extremely challenging to capture the hidden lives of wolves in a rainforest environment like this.
It also seems, I mean, as you just said, you've known them as pups, and then you've seen them grow up. You've seen some die in sort of unpleasant circumstances, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, it's quite incredible to really immerse yourself into wolf society or culture, and you know, they're incredibly intelligent animals, but you know, they also, and I try to make this parallel in the book, that they, you know, live within their means. They have to, and so this idea that wolves are indiscriminate or bloodthirsty or you know, savage in a careless way is so erroneous. It's not the case at all. They maintain their numbers, and sometimes that means that individuals have to leave a pack, which is a really difficult decision, but you know, it is made by the leadership of the pack so that they can maintain an existence off the territory that they defend. So in a way, wolves really are living within their means. And you know, when you compare that to what we're doing to this planet and how humans are just, you know, gobbling up all the resources of this planet like there's no tomorrow, it's rather remarkable how, you know, we consider wolves to be much more careless in how they function in the environment. So I see a lot of parallels like that, and I think wolves in particular.
Sea lions, they seem nice, they seem gregarious.
Yeah, they are, and you know, they're increasing in numbers, and it's, I think, one of the success stories that we're seeing on the BC coast, that marine mammals are returning in certain areas, and Stellar sea lions are one of them. And so, you know, when we're doing winter dive trips and mapping out reef systems and doing underwater filming and photography, we're often visited by sea lions, which is, you know, at first quite unnerving, but, you know, after a while you get used to the fact that they really are just extremely curious and playful, and unfortunately don't consider humans as part of the menu.
Yeah. So all the animals and the creatures that are in your neck of the woods, they're represented in this book, are they?
Well, as many as you know, as possible. There's only a room for 100 or so images in a book of this size, so yeah. You have to, take.
But it's a good sense, I guess, of what one can find there, right?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the idea of the book was to really showcase this amazing interface between the ocean and the rainforest, and how, you know, there's so many species that are moving seamlessly between these two worlds, and that, you know, we tend to view the ocean and the land as somehow separate. But yet, you know, in a place like this that is still functioning and still hosts the full suite of flora and fauna, and so much of that life is stacked up upon each other right at the tide line or interface between those two worlds, that the idea of the ocean supporting land and vice versa was always in the back of my mind in terms of producing images, so that's why there's quite a few images from below the surface looking up into the rainforest. Mm-hmm. And trying to capture intertidal life. And you know, there's one picture that I really love where a pack of wolves were feeding on herring eggs every day, and I was able to swim up to them and capture an image of them with their feet underwater and the seaweed and the rich tidal zone, but also the forest above. And you know, I just love the idea that wolves were actually a terrestrial species that was making its living from the ocean, and not in a opportunistic or incidental way, but one that probably is an ancient relationship, and one that probably for thousands of years the ancestors of those same wolves have been going to the same areas to feast on herring eggs that are laid and deposited on the beach. It's a great food source for them, and it's you know, we know from midden records that herring have been on this coast for well over 10,000 years, and assuredly that's just one example of where ocean and rainforest meet.
There's also a marvelous shot in the book of the bear, the black bear, catching a salmon midair, and I'm wondering how long that took to get that shot.
Uh, Yeah, probably quite a while. Yeah, I've been to that waterfall quite a few times. But yeah, that image actually worked out really well. And I love the fact that it's also a black bear. You know, people often associate just grizzly bears as having the ability to catch great big coho salmon in midair. But in that case, it's a black bear. And you know, again, it's a sort of an image that a lot of people have seen, but I think it also is another one of these examples of the ocean, you know, feeding the creatures of the rainforest, and you know, how the idea of salmon migrations defying gravity, and it's one of the biggest upslope nutrient transfers migrations that exist on planet Earth, and it's happening right here in our very own backyard.
So you've been there for about 20 years. Has it changed a great deal physically in the two decades that you've been there?
Well, gosh, that's a tough question. You know, it's hard to know whether, you know, this coast is changing or if I'm changing, and just having, you know, more insight into the incredible complexities of the natural cycles that exist here. And every year seems to bring more and more, you know, insight into how rich this coast is, and how intertwined all of these relationships between species are. You know, for example, these incredible migrations of herring that come inshore in the early spring, and the countless species that they're feeding both in the rainforest and in the ocean, and these ooligan runs that go into the mainland rivers in the springtime. And there's just really so many seasons that are expressed by, you know, these great natural history events. You know, when the humpback whales come in from Hawaii, and we're now seeing fin whales on the coast here, which is, you know, the second largest animal ever to have inhabited planet Earth, is now a common sight in the Great Bear Rainforest area. And yeah, there's just so many different great events that happen up here. So I keep thinking that the coast is actually witnessing a resurgence of life, but perhaps I'm just getting to understand it better. We certainly are seeing, though, a resurgence in our oceans. We're seeing the return of animals that have been vacant from this coast, largely because of the dark days of the commercial whaling industry and the fur trade, and total open season trophy hunting of bears and whatnot. So we're starting to see these species returning here, and I think the timing of that is really remarkable, because, you know, at the same time that we're deciding the fate of this coast because of the all of these energy proposals, you know, all of these pipeline projects for liquid natural gas and bitumen and condensate and refineries and liquefaction plants, and you know, just a huge potential proliferation of shipping traffic, tankers. You know, these are threats unlike anything we've ever faced before, unlike anything this coast has ever faced before. And so, at the same time, though, there's this great sense of hope for our oceans, because, you know, we're seeing herring returning, we're seeing sea otters returning, and because the sea otters are coming back, these great kelp forests are filling up bays and coves and inlets now, because you know, they're such an important keystone species that they're regulating the urchin population, which was devastating our kelp forests. And because of that, the return of these kelp forests, we're seeing rockfish and herring returning, because they use kelp forests as a nursery, and we're seeing the return of sea lions, and we're seeing white-sided dolphins and porpoises and fin whales and elephant seals and all of these species that have largely been absent from big parts of this coast. They're returning now, and, you know, and it's giving people a real sense of hope at a time when it's probably most needed, because you know, we really fundamentally have to make a decision as Canadians whether we're going to turn our back on this coast and turn it into an energy superhighway, or are we going to say no to all of these pipeline proposals to ship energy to Asia, and whereby we stand up for this place and protect this coast and the people that depend on it. And so these are huge decisions that we have to make in the very short time ahead of us. And I think based on the decisions that we make, it's going to define us as a nation. It's that large and profound, and I think we will be judged by future generations by the decisions we make in the short term.
So let's say all this stuff comes to pass, they build the pipeline, you get a lot of tanker traffic through there. Even if the worst case scenario doesn't happen, like a spill or something like that, it'll certainly change what you see out your window, I guess, won't it?
Oh, yeah, it would just completely, irreversibly, and fundamentally change everything that we know about this coast. And I think your point about even in the absence of, say, an Exxon Valdez-type spill, the damage will occur. And there's a lot of focus on oil spills and our ability to clean them up and mitigate them, but it's really not the issue. The issue is, the air quality that these ships will change. The issue is this chronic shipping noise that will destroy the acoustic environment for whales and fish and so many other species. The issue around invasive species that will come in when the bilge water is discharged here. The issue of how it'll impact First Nations use of the ocean and lands and the noise pollution and the climate altering products that these ships are carrying and what that's going to do to the world's oceans and acidification and increased temperature and rising sea levels. And you know, these are issues of a global scale and of global nature, and there's nothing good that will come of building these pipelines.
And do you find as you travel the province that people are hip to this, that they're realizing? I mean, our politicians may be on a different page altogether, but the people themselves, not just in your community but elsewhere, that they're under, I mean, we're seeing this, I guess, on Burnaby Mountain right now. People are caring, and people are doing something about it.
Well, yeah, you know, I think if you'd asked me that 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, it might have been a different answer. But I think for Pacific Northwesters, people are really waking up to the enormity of this threat and how this isn't going to be solved by any First Nation band or environmental group or any individual elected leader, but you know, this has to be solved by everybody taking some responsibility and taking action in whatever creative way that people can. That you know, this is an issue that no one will be spared being impacted if it goes ahead. And so, you know, there has to be a larger sense of personal responsibility. And I think as I've been touring around, even throughout Alberta, I've been seeing that people realize that there's hard decisions that have to be made, and it involves everyone.
Ian, this is such a gorgeous book. Continued good luck with it, and good luck to you with all of your endeavors. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Oh, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the time.
The book is called Great Bear Wild Dispatches from a Northern Rainforest. It's a great book. Do get it. It's just a handsome book as well. It's from Greystone Books. It's author and photographer Ian McAllister joined me on the line from Denny Island, British Columbia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.